This is the panel on Writer's Craft Twists versus Gimmicks. And we're going to start out with a quick introduction from the panelists, starting all the way far away from me as you can get. And then we'll get into it.
Okay. My name is Brian McClellan. I am the guy who forgot to actually pick up a name tag when I got my badge. I write the Powder Mage Trilogy, which is Flintlock Epic Fantasy. First one's Promise of Blood, and that's what I do.
My name is Gregory Wilson. I'm a professor of English at St. John's University in Queens, New York. I teach courses in fantasy, science fiction, creative writing, and others. Also an author. First novel, The Third Sign, came out a few years back. Next few are being shopped. My novel, Icarus, is being transcribed, if you will, into a graphic novel, which will be due out in a couple of months from Silence and the Library Publishing. I also have short stories in various anthologies. And my other hat is that I co-host a podcast called Speculate, the podcast for writers, readers, and fans, with Brad Bollier, who's a member of the symposium here, that interviews and discusses the work of various authors, editors, artists from across the speculative fiction field, people like Brian McClellan and Howard Andrew Jones and Donald Bingle, also Kij Johnson and Kay Jemison, Brandon Sanderson, soon to be Jim Butcher, and Leckie, Lev Grossman, and a bunch of others. And if you want to know about that, you can check us out at speculatesf.com.
I'm Howard Andrew Jones. I write a swashbuckling Arabian fantasy series for St. Martin's, and I write Pathfinder Tales for the Paizo Pathfinder Group. Oh, and this is, I'm just so excited, I got to show this to you. I now have an action figure for my Paizo Pathfinder character. You know, it's the little things in life that really...
I'm Cassandra Rose Clark. I write novels, lots of different kinds. I write YA. I have a YA adventure fantasy series that's out right now. The first book is called The Assassin's Curse, and that is the cover that's on my... the cover that's on my name tag. I also have an adult science fiction novel out called The Mad Scientist's Daughter, which was nominated for a Philip K. Dick Award. Which was exciting.
Yeah.
And I actually have another adult science fiction novel that will be coming out from Saga Press, the new Simon & Schuster imprint, in about a year, fall 2015. So that just got announced, so I thought I'd share.
And as I said, I'm Donald J. Bingle. I'm a gamer-turned-writer, three novels which could all be loosely classified as thrillers, and more than 40 published short stories and a wide variety of genres, many of which have reveals of one sort or another. So this is a topic that I have strong opinions about, and we'll see if anybody agrees with them as we go through the course of this. So I guess with the panel, the first thing I want to start with, you know, the title of this is Twist versus Gimmick. And so I want to get a little bit of information from each of you, if I can, as to what you think is a gimmick rather than a twist, and why maybe you don't want to use gimmicks. And we'll start here with
Cassandra. Yeah, I was actually taking notes on this earlier because I had to sit down and really kind of collect my thoughts. I think for me, a gimmick or a gimmicky story is sort of like what I call O. Henry stories. They're also called Shaggy Dog stories, where the story is set up kind of like a joke. You have this story, and then there's a twist at the end that sort of calls everything into question, and it's usually very disappointing. I don't know if you guys have ever read O. Henry, but that's why they're named after him. And then so there's this twist at the end, and it just sort of, when it's done badly, everything falls apart before. And the story winds up feeling like a joke, and when you've heard it once, or you've read it once, you don't really want to go back and read it again. I think the difference between that and an effective twist is that if you have an effective twist in your plot, you do want to go back. And there's a lot of enjoyment in going back and reading it a second time and seeing what you missed and seeing how everything builds up to that twist. It's much more organic. Whereas gimmicks are just there to be kind of like the shock factor, I guess. So that's kind of, that was sort of the difference that I came up with when I was thinking about this earlier.
I think that's a brilliant definition. Do you think that there is any kind of a good gimmick? You think you could have a good one?
Probably.
Yeah? Because while you were talking, I was trying to think of, well, what would make a good gimmick? I don't know.
Well, like, what I thought of was, like, M. Night Shyamalan, which, like, with the when the Sixth Sense came out, everybody loved it. Like, oh, this is so brilliant. I'm going to spoil it for you, but Bruce Willis is dead. He's a ghost. And everybody's like, oh, my gosh. But then when he keeps doing that, so, like, the first time it was kind of cool, and so that you had that twist, and it was a little gimmicky, but then when he kept doing it, everybody was, like, stupid. So that is kind of my sort of, like, that's probably an example of a good gimmick. And Henry is, some people like his stories.
I will say there was an over and under on how long it would take someone to say Shyamalan. it was predicted early, but not quite this early. See your bookie. Go on down the line.
Oh, okay. All right, so I was just thinking about the Shulman Hitchcock comparison. I think I'll make a comparison about that in a minute. I think the big difference between the twist and the gimmick is that the gimmick, in some ways, is breaking faith with your readers. A twist that's done well is essentially carrying forth what has been done before, so that even if you didn't expect it, you could go back over it and you could say, yep, okay, but I could see how this would have led to this, would have led to this, as opposed to giving your reader a certain series of assumptions and things about your world that are true, and then in some ways at the last minute you're like, but just joking, right? It's the Bobby in the shower scene, those, you know, the old Dallas soap opera, where everything you just saw, never mind, it was all just a dream. Classic example of a gimmick and a badly rendered gimmick, because it means that everything that happened before, in a way, didn't matter. You know, in a way, it was all irrelevant, and all the time that was invested in it, and all the interest and all the value that was put in it by the viewers kind of didn't make a difference in the end. It's cheap, and it's usually an example of someone who's kind of run out of ideas, and they're like, none of it happened, you know, and that's the way they kind of get out of painting themselves out of the corner. I think an example of the difference between a good twist where that doesn't happen and a gimmick is the difference between someone like Alfred Hitchcock and most of his movies, and Schlemihan and most of his movies. Although I'll disagree slightly, because I think Unbreakable is a better movie than Sixth Sense, and I think it's better because Unbreakable doesn't rely on the guess what. Now, there is a guess what thing at the end, but that's not really relevant to the story. Arguably, you could have removed it and had just as cool a story, but whatever. It's interesting anyway that twist happens at the end, but it's not relevant. What's relevant is, again, Bruce Willis discovering aspects of his character, learning something about who he is, learning what matters to him, why he values it. And so the whole thing doesn't hinge on the dun-dun, which I do think Sixth Sense really does rely on. Whether that is breaking faith with the reader, I don't know. I think you could go back over the Sixth Sense and see ways that it was particularly filmed and structured in such a way that it wouldn't necessarily feel like a gimmick, but I just don't think it's as strong, and I think Unbreakable does less of that. But anyway, but the reason that someone like Hitchcock, I think, does this better is because the twist in some ways intensifies or heightens what was already there. Take an example of a movie like Psycho. When we find out who actually Bates is, right, and who the person who's been doing the murders is, it heightens the sense of creepiness and there's something very wrong here and, oh my God, I knew it all along, that you were feeling anyway. It wasn't like you came along and thought, this guy is a wonderful gentleman. Oh my God, no, right? In this case, it's a twist which heightens everything and increases the power of what happened before, as opposed to sort of being like, whoops, just kidding, because the just kidding thing is dangerous. We as authors are all involved to a certain degree in manipulation. We all do that to a certain degree. That's part of the art of what we do. But where it becomes abusive, in my mind, is when it becomes something where we, in essence, break the rules, break the faith that we put up with our readers to begin with. So our readers, in a way, are kind of like, well, thanks a lot for nothing. And I think when we break faith, that's when we're dealing with a gimmick, in my view.
I feel like it kind of breaks down to, like, reader reaction. Just for me, it's a gimmick is something that makes you go, ugh, whereas a twist is something that makes you go, ah. And it's all about kind of, well, like what he was saying, it's kind of like an honesty thing with the reader. Whereas if you're, you know, if it's out of left field and there's no foreshadowing, there's nothing,
yep.
Then that's a gimmick. And the reader goes, oh, well, I feel cheated. And if it's done right, and they'll look back and say, holy crap, I should have seen that coming. There's a, there's a twist, Brent Weeks that does these twists amazingly, and there's a twist in Blinding Knife, the second of his Lightbringer series, where halfway through it, you say, holy crap, if he had done this slightly differently, it would have wrecked the series. But he did it brilliantly, and it worked. And the same with the first of his books. And he's kind of gotten to be known with this. I've had the third book, I don't think it's quite out yet, but we share an editor, so I've had it sitting in my inbox for like a month and a half. And I really want to read it because I want to see what else he's going to throw at me. You know, you could also look at, say The Usual Suspects. You can dissect that movie super easily if you look at it with an analytical eye, of course. But the first time you watch it, you're so wrapped up in it that, you know, 99% of people are going to say, holy crap, no way! And it's just, you know, that's a cool twist. And it's not just something that you're going to hate.
And by the way, one of the ways that was done so effectively, and I won't give away more than I have to, but I guess I will give away more than I have to. It's an old movie. You're stuck with it. Run fleeing from the room if you don't want spoilers. Is that the director secretly told every single person that they were really Kaiser Soze. Before the filming started. And they all believed they were the one. And so when you get the twist as to who is, it really is somewhat surprising because everybody was playing as if they were on a very subconscious level. And that's kudos to him for that directing guidance. In terms of gimmicks, I think there's a couple things I want to say about that. Things to avoid in your writing. If you are writing a story in which the reveal or the twist is that these are cows, or these are aliens, or these are ants, or something is being revealed, that if this was being filmed or actually seen in person by a bystander, they would obviously know from the very beginning. That, to me, is a gimmick, and it's a very weak reveal. If your twist at the end is a play on words, that's a weak twist and a weak reveal, I believe. And, you know, one of the things that I think it was Greg was saying about the Bobby in the shower thing, you know, I've written a lot of reveals, and I will do a spoiler on my own work, and now nobody will have to buy it, but... my first novel involves a time when most of the world is converted to virtual reality. It's very upfront about that. And near the end of the book, you find out that the main characters are, in fact, in virtual reality. And that, you know, that was a dangerous thing to do because it can be the, you know, oh, all the time I invested in this is wasted because now I have no sympathy. The reason I did that is because the point of the book is that the character, this isn't a game. This is somebody whose only existence now is in virtual reality. And he is convinced every time that he is in the real world and he has the worst couple of weeks of his life. And then right near the end of that experience, he finds out that he's in virtual reality and he's going to have to go through it all again. And for me, that makes it more heartbreaking for that character because he knows he faces an eternity of being put through terrible circumstances, not identical circumstances, but terrible circumstances because he's being used as a control to test certain things in the system. And that's what he signed up for in a way that he didn't understand. Have a few people said, oh, Bobby in the shower? Yes. Those people, I understand that criticism. I can't have this conversation with them. I've had other people who understand that the point was that it made it more tragic, not less tragic. But that's the kind of thing that you need to think about. Does the twist make the story deeper, richer, more emotional, or does it detract from it?
Let me jump off that for a second. One of the things that can sometimes make that happen is when the twist or gimmick actually occurs in the course of the book. If you've read Brandon Sanderson's Mistborn, there is a significant twist, I think a brilliantly done one actually, about who the protagonist really is. Because the protagonist is not who you think it is when you begin reading the novel. It actually changes about midway through, maybe halfway to two-thirds through. It's very gutsy to do that because the main character is very likable and very heroic in a lot of ways and very interesting and engaging. And just like everybody flipped out when they found out what happened to Ned Stark in the HBO series, and the book readers are like, or occasionally, whatever the case may be. But just as those people did that, those people who had really invested in this character could be like, wait, what are you? And the reason I think that he can get away with it is because he's then got half to a third of the book left to essentially sell to you the protagonist that is put in place instead. And the benefit of that is that once that book is over, you are then locked into this author and series, I think, because you then believe, okay, like, he's not going to screw with me that much. He will do things that changes the field, and I'll have to be on my toes. And it's interesting and sort of engaging, I think, as a reader, to be kept on your toes by the author that you're reading. But he's not going to do something which is going to invalidate the effort that I put into his world, because the, I won't say replacement protagonist, but this other character who sort of steps forward to center stage, it turns out to be just as engaging, as interesting as the one previous, and in fact is made more engaging and interesting because that character, in a way, is forced to take over for the one who sort of cedes the field to this character. So depending on when you put it in the book, in the novel, that makes a big difference, I think, as well, because you have enough time to turn what some might view as a gimmick into a twist.
I guess also going off of that, I guess I'd like to hear people on the panel comment about reader expectations. Certainly Shyamalan, after Sixth Sense, there was an expectation of a reveal that maybe made people more hyper to catch the reveal. And, and once he tries two reveals, and then by the third, people are second-guessing everything that happens. So how much of that comes into decisions you make in terms of writing a reveal?
Well, I think that's a good point. I think that is a big part of it. This is to kind of bounce off what you were saying about Mistborn. It's been a while since I read that, but I seem to recall that the twist was sort of in the service of deconstructing certain fantasy tropes. Sort of.
The whole book kind of is.
The whole book is kind of doing that. And so is Song of Ice and Fire. So I always felt like, in that case, the authors are purposely kind of messing around with reader expectations. I don't know if this is exactly what you're asking. I'm going to go off on my own tangent, so I'm sorry. But the author is purposely messing around with reader expectations. I mean, George R. R. Martin really does it, obviously. I mean, that's his whole thing. With what happens with Ned and also with what happens with the Red Wedding, I think in both of those cases, he's taking the reader expectations. He's like, I know what you think you know what's going to happen in this because it's a fantasy novel, but no, right? I'm going to cut that off, literally. But Mistborn was doing the same thing, although not as violently. And so I wonder if maybe like the twist in Mistborn was effective because it was kind of a subversion of expectations. Mm-hmm. And so that's what lent it, like you were talking about, lent it depth to the story. Mm-hmm. But I think your point about it, where it's happening, is important as well. But I do think twists are all about reader expectations. It's all about taking what the reader thinks is going to happen and flopping it around, which is why when you have someone like Shyamalan, when you're expecting the twist, well, then you're just second-guessing everything. You're like, oh. Or if you go into something knowing there's going to be a twist, that's ruined stories for me, too. The movie The Others, the Nicole Kidman movie. I didn't know what the twist was, but I read that there was a twist, and I figured it out like 15 minutes into the movie, just because I knew there was going to be a twist, and so that...
So you were looking for the
twist. I was looking for it. So it ruined my experience of that movie, honestly. But I do think that twists always go back to reader expectations. That's what I was trying to say.
I guess the twists that I incorporate, I write adventure novels, right? But like a lot of adventure novel writers, there's a lot of elements of mystery in a good adventure. I mean, look at the Harry Potter novels. Mm-hmm. Those are really mysteries, right? There's always information that we don't know. And those are kind of like smaller twists, right? Who's in the first book, we think we're being sort of misled that Snape might be the bad guy, right? Well, he's not really, but he sure is an ass, right? So that's not a gimmick. Is that a twist? Well, maybe it's a mild twist, right? We're being misled a little bit. And I guess I like those kinds of twists. Is it a gimmick that she misled us with Snape? I'm not sure. And maybe I'm not sure about the question anymore either.
Well, the question is really how do your expectations play into how you write reveals?
Yeah. Well, I think that when you're doing something that's very clearly like a whodunit or something like that, you know, that's part of the expectation. You know, people are looking for that and they want it. And if you do the obvious, that's going to piss people off just as much as if you had sprained something out of left field, you know, in just, you know, a regular novel. That balancing that reader expectation, you know, like I was saying earlier with Brent Weeks, you know, I'm expecting something big in his third book that's a big twist. And I was thinking about that on the way walking over here, and I was thinking, that's got to be stressful for him. Because he knows he has to do something mind-blowingly, like, boom, like this, in his books, because people expect it now. Whereas when you read the first one, you weren't expecting it. And maybe even when you read the second one, you weren't terribly expecting it, because, oh, he already did something, you know, moving on. But once you have a pattern going on, you know, that is the new reader expectation.
Yeah, which means be really careful about setting up patterns. You're like, book three, damn it, how do I? I think the other thing about the expectation point is you as the author are responsible, right, for establishing those expectations, which means you have certain things which ultimately need to be paid off later in the book, or theoretically sometimes later in the series. If you don't pay them off, if you set up questions that ultimately don't get answers, or get sort of obscure non-answers that you sort of claim to be some sort of artistic thing, and yet really the reader is like, I can't believe you made me read X number of books to try to find out that you didn't know the answer yourself. The reader will think either that you're incompetent or a jerk, and neither one is a, you know, positive endpoint. But I think if you establish expectations that they themselves may have their, you know, expectations questioned, like the example you were given about more about Brandon's book, then you're onto something. I'll use an example of a playwright here. Harold Pinter, who's one of my favorites, writes a play called The Dumbwaiter. I'm going to spoil it for you. I'm sorry. That's the title of this panel. We just spoil everything. And also Dumbledore. Anyway. So The Dumbwaiter is about these two hitmen. And they go to this place waiting for this hit to happen, and they're going to be given these instructions, this information about who it is. One's a younger guy, one's an older guy. There's a big discussion between the two of them. You learn something about both of their characters. They're in this room where there's one of those dumbwaiters, like those old trays, you know, that ascended to the kitchen and then descended to the room with the food on it. So that things are brought on and down, you know, there. And Pinter was partially an absurdist playwright, so part of it is sort of learning the absurd of the world that they're in. But so at one point, towards the very end of the play, young man goes out. He says he's going to go to the bathroom. He leaves. And the dumbwaiter rings, and the guy picks out this note. And the note, it is revealed to the audience, basically says that his job is to, the hit is the young hitman. He's supposed to kill the young hitman that's with him. And the next thing you see is the young hitman stumbles in to the room with his jacket around his arms, and he's all basically trussed up. And the older hitman, who's gotten to know this guy, just looks at him, and then the lights go out. Now, and that's the end of the play. Now, there's some people who could look at that and be like, that's a gimmick and that's crap and you didn't know how to end the play. I don't think so, because it was never about whether or not the guy's going to kill him or not. That's something for you to decide, and it's not relevant to their character. What's interesting about it is that it heightens what we know of each of them, what it is that they've gone through, their own character arcs, the things that have made them into who they are, and that last moment, in a way, is the thing that you will remember walking away from it thinking, you know, I think, based on what I know of the older hitman. He's not going to kill the younger hitman because blah, 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 blah. Or, you know what? I think the older hitman totally is going to kill the younger hitman because remember when he did this, so blah, 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 blah. And you will remain talking about it and thinking about it and considering it and perhaps even talking to panels at Gen Con about it for many years after you've first seen it because it was that powerful to you. That, to me, is not a gimmick. It's a twist. It highlights and heightens everything that happened before, and it is playing with those expectations. The expectations in this case were, we want to know more about these two characters, and it does not violate that simply because it doesn't provide the answer at the end. But again, Pinter knew exactly what he was doing in heightening your interest in the characters, and knowing the expectations that you establish and that you're establishing them is critical if you're going to do this right, I think.
And I think the point is correct about the pressure that this can put on writers. If you would, you know, if you look at that pressure and how it is handled in various examples, even if that's on something like the television show Lost, or looking at how we ended up with the unsatisfying third Matrix movie, I mean, there are there were such pressure to now tie everything together and give us an answer that crowdsourcing the universe has not come up with already. And, crowdsourcing is very effective at finding solutions to problems. And if you're going to try and do a reveal that no one has guessed and probably posted, it's going to be very difficult for you. I think one thing that I like to keep in mind when I'm writing reveals is that my audience is not uniform. My audience consists of people who are just reading this to read the story and enjoy the story. And then there's a certain class of people which I call meta readers. They're reading it because they want to figure out the mystery. They want to figure out where the twist may come, where the reveals might be. And you have to, I think, try to satisfy both levels of readers. And so often when I will do a reveal, I will do one of two things, or maybe both of them. I'm not going to give away all my secrets. One is to convince the meta readers as to what it is early on, and then in the middle of the novel, convince them that they might have been wrong. And then at the end, they get the reveal that they were expecting, but they had that moment of doubt, and so they still feel somewhat satisfied, both because they figured it out and they're smart, and because you kept them engaged. The other thing is a kind of second-level reveal. You do two reveals, one of which is to focus the attention of the meta readers on what reveal might be occurring, and then a second one, which they only didn't see coming. Not because it's brand new, oh, we're introducing a new character in the last 15 seconds. No, it's because they were paying too much attention to the less interesting reveal to be seeing the clues that you were setting up for the first reveal. There are tropes in reveals. What did Agatha Christie say about mysteries? The first suspect must be the second to die. Because that is what keeps, so-and-so, oh, they died. Well, they can't be the murderer. And then, you play with that in Ten Little Indians. Retitled since. So I think that's something to keep in mind when you're talking about reveals. Now, I also want to ask since we're talking about people, mostly in the audience, who are writing and want to write stories for anthologies and want to write novels, how do you think it's best to approach a publisher or an agent or somebody when you're talking about a story that involves a reveal? I have an opinion on this, but I want to hear, and we're going to start down with Brian this time first.
Like when you're pitching to an agent or an editor?
Yeah.
What I've been told by my agent was, give me everything immediately. Tell me exactly what happens. I want to know the ending right now, because when you're pitching to them, they want to know whether that sounds like it's going to be interesting. If you say this and this and this happens, and then the hero finds out this important piece of information, but
He's actually a dog.
And yeah. then you
no wonder no one understands me.
And you leave it you leave it as a cliffhanger in your query. Yeah. It's just gonna annoy them.
Yep.
Because they're gonna know all your secrets and ins and outs. They're not a reader, they're not a fan. I mean, they are on level, but it's a very different level than most readers are.
Well, they want to know.
Your partner. Yeah.
They want to know that you've got a product that's going to work. So they want to know that you know how to introduce the structure and deliver the structure, and you know what you're doing. They don't want to be surprised. And that's not their job.
They want to know right now whether the twist is really dumb.
They want to know if you know how to end a book.
Right. Agents and editors, an agent's gonna accept 1 out of 1,000 manuscripts that are, given to them. They do not have time to read all that, so they want to know up front.
Yeah, we just talked about this earlier today on a panel about the synopsis, where we were, talking about exactly that, that they want to know all this stuff sort of up front. I think it is possible to highlight a moment when you're giving them, let's say, a synopsis. It's not going to happen in the query letter, but when you're doing the synopsis or something like that, which normally is the second step, they say, okay, this is good. Send me the first, 3 chapters or 50 pages of the manuscript and a synopsis. In the synopsis, it is possible to say, at this point, it is revealed to the reader, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And one thing to keep in mind is, because I always like to think about how these things benefit also the writing process, if you are writing it and you write, and at this point, the reader realizes that blah, 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 they were a dog or whatever, if you look at it and go, that's really dumb, it means it probably was really dumb. And the fact that you couched it in beautiful prose and it took 15 pages to talk about the very dumb idea doesn't change that it was very dumb, and that you need to do it in a different fashion. So I think that's one of the reasons why, even though I don't particularly care for query letters and they can be frustrating, but I think it's a very good skill and it can be very useful to reveal aspects of your work to you so that as you're in the process of describing it, if when you say this is the reveal and you're like, oh, what? That means probably the agent is going to go, oh, what, before tossing it. It's better for you to have that reaction so you can change things in such a way that it's not, going to seem as lame or cliched to you, and thus will not do so to an agent or editor either.
I don't know that I can add too much to that. Clear, concise, upfront, no secrets. When you're presenting to your agent or your editor, if they're interested in you, don't surprise them. Oh, by the way, I'm actually already married. You don't say that when you're on the altar, right? So, just be upfront.
You want soap operas?
Yeah.
You don't want a soap opera with your editor and your agent.
Yes.
You want trust. You want them to trust you. You want to be able to trust them. Yeah.
I had a discussion with my agent a couple of weeks ago where I was talking about a project I was working on. And we went through it, and she wasn't sounding all that interested. And then I thought, oh, wait a second. And I said this to her. I said, wait a second. I forgot to add this and this.
The protagonist, the dog.
And
right.
She says, that makes it way more interesting. You need to lead with that. I'm like, oh, sorry. I'll do so.
Yeah.
I have nothing to add. It's a common mistake for young writers to, what will Johnny do, at the end of their query letter? And, the agent or the publisher can say, I don't know what Johnny is doing, but this is going to be fine.
Exactly.
Because yeah. they really want to have that information. Now, I also want to kind of segue into a related thing, which is anthologies. And there are many themed anthologies. Now, there are not as many since Daw dropped out of the anthology market, but there are many themed anthologies. And they, I think, present some unusual issues for writers in terms of reveals and in terms of gimmicks, and with the two not necessarily being in juxtaposition there. Because when you are asked to write or you submit to an open call for a themed anthology, one of the things that is almost necessarily true is that you have seen and will see none of the other stories. And they're going to be getting a bunch of submissions if it's an open call. And even if it's not an open call, if it's by invitation, they're going to be getting 10 or 16 or 20 or 30 stories on this topic. And I think to have any success, as in getting your stories considered for those types, especially of open calls, one thing that you need to have in the back of your mind as a writer is, how do I write a story that is absolutely true to the request? Because you never want to go outside, you know, supposed to be a certain length, supposed to be at a certain time, supposed to be on a certain subject, supposed to involve certain characters, whatever the request is. You need to follow those guidelines. But then you need to think, how can I make my story different from everyone else's? Because if you're asked to write a circus story, and you've got creepy clowns, how many stories are they going to get with creepy clowns? You know, and more than one. And therefore, yours has to be the best creepy clown story to be involved, you know, to be considered. But if you do something that is a little outside of the box in terms of your story, you may be the only story that has that, you know, the twist, the little kind of shading, the topic that nobody else has. I did a circus story. I avoided creepy clowns. Mine was about canvas, which when I say, sometimes people say, oh, you wrote the most boring story ever. But it was haunted canvas, and there were creepy things about it, and it worked quite well. And I knew when I sent that in, it was the only story they were going to get about haunted canvas. You know, that's just one thing, you know. Now, it could have been good, could have been bad. They could have said, that's a stupid gimmick. But it is a way to distinguish yourself, and that's very, I think, important for anthologies. And I'm interested in whether people have their own stories or disagree with that. They think it's too gimmicky or what?
I mean,
Jump in, anybody.
I would never disagree with haunted canvas, clearly. I do think that it's important to be able to write something which will be distinguishable as a strong story on its own. I'll disagree slightly, or not even disagree, but just sort of throw out the caveat that I do believe that stories that are reliant upon the dun-dun are not as good. In fact, I'm fairly convinced that almost all stories that are reliant on dun-dun are not particularly good in comparison to stories that may have the dun-dun moment but don't rely upon it. So when I am trying to do stories for themed anthologies, I like the story to be able to stand on its own. I also like them to in some ways reflect the heart of what the theme is. So I'd like it to be a good story in part because it's a story that relies on whatever that happens to be. So for example, I did a story for an anthology on monsters. I won't spoil and say what. It would be really spoiling if I told you what the monster is in my story, but it's very evident that there are monsters involved in that story, and part of what's going on is thinking about what we define monsters as, why is something monstrous or not. And I like to think that that story works separate from the, aha, they are this, which happens relatively near the end of the story. And so I think the story needs to rely on its own and not rely on the other, because although haunted canvas is awesome as a concept, I think that you're also running the risk of trying to thread a very fine needle in that you've got to hit, if you're going to do it that's totally based on this somewhat gimmicky thing, it's got to be something which is extremely well executed and they haven't seen it before. It's not cliched. It's also not dumb. It's also, you know, and there's so many sort of moving targets, I think, that you're trying to hit with that one, you know, gimmicky thing, that I would rather take a higher, you know, I guess a higher odds approach and try to produce a story that's great anyway, you know, a story that's going to work on multiple levels, and that way I'm not going to have found myself missing the mark on one of those things. As Don said, I'd heard that story before, and that is really awesome, and it works out well, but I think it's risky, especially for beginning writers, to try to go that path rather than thinking of the story as a whole within which perhaps these themes can be dealt with.
I was recently in an anthology called Kaiju Rising. And Kaiju is really about a monster beating the hell out of a city, right? I mean, Godzilla or two monsters beating the hell out of each other, right? And so I thought, well, what can I do? Because I got to tell you, I've never been that interested watching two monsters beat the hell out of each other. It's not really my thing. But I do have a lot of monsters in the stories I write, or people investigating things man was not meant to know. So what could I do to get into this anthology? And so I found a twist. It wasn't a aha kind of twist, but I found a way to subvert expectations, to get my my two humans involved with the kaiju. But because I subverted expectations a little bit, some people the reviews say, oh, it's one of the best stories in the anthology. And some people say, well, you know, they didn't really fight the kaiju in that one. It was my least favorite. So sometimes if you play with the expectations too much, you get extreme reactions as well.
You lose the kaiju fighter.
Yeah, they're people, they bought the book so that they could read 15 stories of monsters beating the hell out of each other, right? And I didn't give them that, and they were disappointed. And if that's what they wanted, you know, they had a right to be disappointed with mine.
I think it's really important to remember that every single story out there is a series of little tiny twists. You know, whether it's, oh, there's another army coming, or we have a new suspect in the case, or, oh, this person just wound up murdered.
That's true.
You know, at the end of every single chapter is going to be something, some other little tiny twist. So relying on a huge one means that maybe you're not doing, you know, the little ones that propel forward the action of the whole story, that you're not, you know, giving those enough attention. Now, obviously, there's people that do it well. Brent Weeks, I keep mentioning, because it's the best example I can think of. You know, his immensely huge epic fantasies, they move like that, because every single, and the end of every single chapter is a little twist. And I feel like that's kind of the writing that I like the most and that moves the quickest is always like that. And it doesn't have to be big. It doesn't have to be big at all. It can be the littlest tiny things, but if they're important to the characters, if they're important to the story, then you just keep moving things forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, now I'm going to have to write down a resolution to finally read Brent Weeks, okay?
Yeah, the little, the smaller reveals at the end of chapters, or the smaller cliffhangers suggesting a reveal that they can find out in the next chapter, or maybe two chapters down the line if you're switching points of view. You know, those are the things that compel readers to read another chapter. Sorry about that. I do have to check time occasionally. You want those people to be compelled to read the next chapter, because if they put down your book because they're not compelled to read the next chapter, they may never pick it up. And one of the things that Amazon can do with Kindles, which I wish they would make available to authors, but so far they haven't, is they know precisely from Kindle statistics and reading patterns how far people get into books before they stop reading, if they're a book that they stop reading before the end. And, you know, and I think that that's really, I think that's something that authors would love to know. They might then all commit suicide, but they would love to know it before they die, because it tells you where you've lost the reader's attention, where you've made a mistake of some kind. It may be a mistake of pacing, it may be a mistake of plot, it may be a mistake of character, but you need to compel that interest all the way along, and that's why one of the things that I think is important about reveals, or double reveals, or whatever maybe, is that the clues need to be there. They need to be, and I find it, by the way, as a writer, I find it very difficult to place clues in a rewrite. I think clues are much more subtle if they're done in my first draft. Mm-hmm. And so I would recommend, you know, I'm going to place a bunch of clues later, but I want to get through the main action first. Because the clues that you then go back and place will not fit in the flow quite as well. And readers may not know why they focus in on them, but they will focus in on them. And I'll use one example, Angels and Demons. A friend of mine really loved Angels and Demons, and she gave it to me, and she said, you need to read this. And, you know, fine, so I took it. And the next day she's like, so, you know, did you read it? And it's like, well, I'm not done yet. I'm only, you know, five chapters in, or four chapters in, or whatever it was, the very beginning of the book. But I said, I'll tell you that the last scene will involve so-and-so piloting a helicopter and will take place in this location. And it's like, how the fuck do you know that? It's kind of like, because they told us twice in two chapters unnecessarily that he was a helicopter pilot, and they made, it was very unsubtle when they referred to this one location. And, you know, if you're a writer, by the way, you will begin to watch movies and read books and be very attuned to that kind of thing. And it will change your reading and may change the pleasure level of your reading forever.
Well, it'll change the pleasure level of the people you're sitting with.
Yeah.
Yes, that's true.
Guess what? That's the helicopter.
But let's talk about, do you find yourself watching movies and reading books and having a different experience than before?
It's really hard to fall between the words anymore. And you know, when you're a kid or when you're first really getting into reading, you accept everything and you just lose it. Now, it really has to be an amazing book for me to fall between the words and stop analyzing it. Fortunately, my wife loves to take things apart, too, so we'll watch stuff together and say, aha, ha, ha. We'll probably make everyone else ill.
I actually don't have that experience. I can watch stuff or read stuff and just whatever. I'm a very forgiving reader and a very forgiving viewer. And it's basically like I have to decide, okay, I feel like analyzing this and then going back and looking at it. But in terms of just reading stuff for fun, I don't do that at all. Everybody says that happens to them, but it never happened to me.
I think it does happen. I think it did happen to me a little bit, but I think it's compensated for by the fact that I now admire the craft much more. And if I don't get the full, swept away, man, when I get a story, I have a friend, Rob Ziegler, who's a very good writer in his own right, who talked about Ian McDonald as being the kind of writer he'd like to punch in the face because he's so good, you know? If you read the opening of The Dervish House, you're like, what, how, you know, and you're just in awe of how good the craft is, and that compensates for a whole lot. Even if you haven't quite got this swept away as my daughter is, you know, by a given story. Some kids are afraid of roller coasters. My kid's afraid of plot tension. You know, four reels. You might have seen her as Elsa today running around. But that's the thing that she gets. But what I get in exchange, I think, is pretty worth it, because being able to see stuff like the opening of The Dervish House and be like, that is unbelievable, and be like, I liked it. No, you have no idea how awesome that really is and how hard to do. That's a good compensation.
Anything to add down at the end of the table?
No, I mean, I deconstruct movies all the time, and my wife gets really pissed at me.
We're going to take one or two questions, then.
How do you feel about twists that are in a book that feels like it's going to be a one-off book, but actually opens it up to a whole series? The twist doesn't actually affect the plot of that book, but it adds something of a mystery that opens up to the next book?
I mean, if it's... One, if it doesn't affect your enjoyment of the book that you just read, if that book was its own encapsulated thing, too. And two, if it doesn't feel like someone at the end said, I think I got a pretty good book, and then the demon came down, right? to open up a second. If it feels as if it's organically sort of fit into the rest of it, the idea that someone can go back over it again and say, oh, I see where there would have been clues about this, 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 and this based upon the rest of the book, then yeah, I think that's great, because it heightens everything, as we've talked about, and it leads into the next one. And frankly, from a practical point of view, if you can get people saying, I want the next book from whatever, you know, that's what you want, I think, as a writer.
The best example is that and it's revealed, like, towards the end of the book that he's actually one of the main characters from the future.
Okay.
So that's what, even though the plot of that story gets resolved, it's like, so how does this person end up becoming a time travel?
Yeah.
I don't see any problem at all setting up a sequel. If you market me a book as a standalone book and it has no ending, and then you say, you know, look for part two in June. I will fling that book across the room. Number one, I will leave you a one-star review on Amazon. And I will never read you again. And I will never read anybody who blurbed you again. Honestly. I seek vengeance. But I interrupted Cassandra.
Well, I was just going to say, to me, the best twists are ones that would lead into a new story. So, like, I think that sounds kind of interesting. Because you're able to finish the main story, but then you have that little twist, and then it's like, okay, now we can bounce off of that. So that was all I was going to say.
Other questions? There.
The twist, as you say, if you have a novel that is slowly pushed by small twists along the way, if you're writing your synopsis, do you kind of just get one generic sentence saying the plot is pushed forward by small twists to this reveal?
That's an excellent question. It depends on how long you have for the synopsis. Were you there for our synopsis panel earlier?
Actually, I
It's fine.
Okay.
I would say the only danger with that is that it makes me worry that what the story ends up being is sort of the prelude to a long, really boring joke, that the only thing that matters is the punchline. And again, the concern there is that there's so much weight that's been placed on the reveal that, boy, that reveal better just blow people away. And I would rather that there's interest that's being kept all the way along, so that if those little twists, because some of them, as Brian says, are twists that can be very small and simply, you know, someone sees someone across a room that they hadn't expected to see at that moment in the, you know, secret masquerade ball or something like that, and they go, wait, what? You know, and that's the moment. You might not reveal that part in the synopsis, but you might also reveal other sort of character revelations, like, wait, this thing happens. The bigger the thing that you remember after the story is over, that's the sort of thing that you do want to mention in your synopsis, because it's one of those, you know, flag posts on which your novel will repeatedly rest over the course of the entire novel. So not every single twist can be summarized with just there's a bunch of twists, but I do think the bigger ones are things that you want to be able to reveal.
You need to follow the through line. If you're gonna convince people to stick with the story, if you're gonna convince an editor or an agent, you need a clear through line. You can leave off the little twists that don't affect that main through line, but you want to have the most interesting and significant and conflict-inducing and character-changing twists. You want to discuss those.
Yeah,
and you want the tone of the synopsis to convey the tone of the book, I would say. We're out of time. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, everyone.